Okay, we're ready to go. So can you give me some background about yourself?
Yes, my name is Tom Walton. I was born in Winnipeg, raised in Vancouver. I joined the militia, the Army Reserves, in 1959, and in 1960 I went regular force. I joined the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, and in 1963 I transferred to the Royal Canadian Engineers and retired in September 1994. Okay. And after release, I drove a school bus for 9 years, and now I'm fully retired. Well, I do volunteer work at the Legion. I'm Sergeant-at-Arms.
Okay. You indicated that you had 7 months of training in the engineer school in Chilliwack. What did you learn there?
Actually, I was the acting troop commander of the heavy equipment troop. I was not required to learn, or I was just put there in a holding position until I took over the regimental sergeant major of the engineer regiment that left for Kuwait, Iraq.
Okay, so can you tell me a little bit about what the engineers do?
Well, I'm a combat engineer. We do demolitions, blowing up things. We do road building, bridge building, building construction, water purification. And at one time we did minefields, but we no longer do that. We also have combat divers in the engineer trade, and we have an airborne element that jumps. We do, on roads, we do all the curb design, just like a civilian contractor, up to the engineer technician level. And the demolitions, we take various courses, including EOD, IED courses, bomb disposal, things like that.
What sort of preparation were you given to leading up to Croatia specifically? What kind of briefing?
Mainly, we were pretty well aware of the what was going on, because 11 months before that we'd come back from Kuwait, but we were told we wouldn't be going anywhere for 2 years, and then 11 months later we were there. But basically, we're told the people that were there, which was mainly the Croatians where we were. But we worked a lot in the Serb side and some on the Muslim side. And they were not very receptive to having a UN there, because when we got there, the Croatians thought we were there to help them take the rest of their land. The Serbs were against us because our camp was in Croatia, and the Muslims just couldn't be bothered. But preparation, we didn't do very much. Not like now.
Yeah, they have a long workup now.
They have a year. Your workup before they go to Afghanistan.
Okay. And can you tell me about your time in Croatia from the beginning?
Yeah. Initially, I went over in August on a reconnaissance with the commanding officer and some other officers, just to see what the layout of the land was and what we were going to be doing and all the rest of it. And I was there for about a week and a half, and we flew back to Chilliwack. And then in September, we went over with, it was between 175 and 200 soldiers, officers and men. And when we got there, we had various jobs. And on different occasions, troops would be called out to pick up mines if it was affecting some UN operation. We didn't pick up any of the minefields for the Croatians or for the Serbs. And then we were building foundations to put accommodations on for the various countries that were there, like Nigeria, Kenya, Finland, and our own Canadian troops. That was about it.
Okay. Can you describe your accommodations?
The accommodations, the soldiers were in a derelict school that we fixed up. It'd been there quite, it was an old school. I'm not talking 40, 50, it was probably older than that, but the soldiers, being what they are, made it quite livable. And within the same building, they had Dutch signalers who were attached to us for communications. The officers and senior NCOs were living in a bombed Jamaican National Army building, which had also been fixed up. And the females, we didn't have any specific rules to go by with them. So they were basically right with the soldiers. And what they would do, they were in bunk beds and they just hang blankets down the side for privacy. And we had showers, and the girls were given a certain time that they had to be there, and there was no problems in that regard. And our messing facilities, we had a giant tent brought from Germany. We replaced a Canadian regiment from Germany, And it was a big party tent, and that's where we had everybody ate in there, plus the entertainment, plus the junior ranks bar, corporals and below.
Can you describe what a normal day would have been like?
For myself?
Yeah.
Well, as a regimental sergeant major, I'm supposed to look at the administration and discipline of the regiment. So I might have some Adam work to do for an hour or two in the morning, but normally what I would do, get up at 5:36, have breakfast, do some PT, if there wasn't an alert on or something like that, and then I would head out in the field to visit various units, because we were spread from Sector East right down to Sector South, which is 800, 900 kilometers, so obviously I couldn't do that in a day, but normally sometimes I would go and spend a night with individual units just to see how they were doing.
As an engineer, you would have had contact with the locals?
Yeah, we had a lot of contact. We had 42 civilians working for us. The head bar girl in our sergeant's mess was a girl named Vitica, and she was married with one son. The village that we stayed at was a place called Derivar. I think it's about an hour and 45 minutes east of Zagreb. The village was a Croatian village, and while we were there, there was the Serbs that stayed, most of their houses were blown up. If they left the house for any reason, for any length of time, then the house would be blown up. There's a subtle way of saying, we don't want you here. I found the locals, you never got into politics with them. Because 20 minutes, sorry.
So we were talking about the locals and your contact with the locals.
Yeah, the locals, although we had mainly Croatians, we had Serbs and a couple of Muslims working for us. They didn't seem to bother the Muslims too much, but there was an underlying hatred between the Serbs and the Croats. We even had a civilian appreciation night, and they all came, and they were singing songs, and they were doing like a hora, like the Israeli hora, you know. But as soon as the music was over, they all went to their little spots. And when I'd be talking to Vitica, because I had a lot to work with her in regards to running the Warrant Officer Sergeant's Canteen Mess. And she would always call them Chetniks, or one was Chetniks, and I can't remember the name of the other one. And that goes back to World War II.
Yeah. Was it Stashy?
Stashy and the Chetniks. Mm-hmm. And she'd go back to that. And things that happened 600 years ago, and they're still mad about it, you know, like... We're trying to say, look, get over this, you guys. You know, it's never going to work. But generally, they're like everybody else. They got paid in German marks. We got paid in German marks because it was the only stable currency. The dinar that they used there was just... The inflation rate was just right off the wall. So they made a lot of money. They were good workers. We had good cooks. And they were cleaning ladies, you name it. They did everything for us. And there was only 42. Personally, I still get a Christmas card from Vitica and her husband, and I sent them one. He was Branko, and the boy was Michael. And he's a grown man now. He's just a little guy there. And Branko, the husband, was involved with the fighting around the village, but it wasn't very much fighting around that village. It was relatively untouched. There's a few buildings that were hit by artillery and things like that. And I was invited to their home for coffee and things like that. I had a good feeling about the people, but I got no desire to go back there.
And did you do any sort of engineering projects related to their infrastructure, or was it mostly... Sorry. No problem.
Hello.
Sorry. Okay, there we go.
Engineer projects. We were not supposed to do any work that... was directly for the civilians themselves, but we did do some road building that was also used by the civilians. The camp we were in, we repaired the garage, the big maintenance garage we had there. The roof was blown off and all the rest of it. We put that roof on and everything else. But when we left, we told the mayor, you either pay us for that roof or we take it apart again. Because as UN, you're supposed to be impartial. And I'll explain that. I was visiting the Serbs one day on the ceasefire line, and this young lieutenant came. He was 22 years old. He'd been Hamilton. He had an uncle in Hamilton, and he'd been there. And he walked me along the trench line, and all of a sudden this round went right beside my head from the Muslims. And he used that as an excuse to put me on about them. And then we spoke some more, and he said, well, we don't trust you anyways because your camp is in Croatia. And I said, the only reason it's in Croatia because you wouldn't let us have it over here. But they don't want to hear that. So indirectly, I guess we did some work for them, but not visibly go out and do a road project for them or repair a house or anything like that. I know there's a Muslim lady that we gave her some furniture and that because she escaped with two of her sons from the heavy fighting. But we were leaving, and this stuff was all going to go in the junk pile. So, and it was good stuff. It was all from Germany, so we took it and gave it to her. But in answer to your question, not directly did we ever do any projects for them. That was mainly the Maudis. And they weren't engineering projects. They were going out and trying to talk in the schools and all this kind of thing. But for us, it was mainly mine clearing. We had to do it, building these stands to put these portable trailers on. Observation posts, we built a lot of those for the infantry and from the different nations and all the rest. Enough to keep us busy for 6 months.
Yeah, for sure. In some of my reading, they talked about doing mine awareness with the locals. Was there any of that? Or
well, they knew more about the mines than we did. Mm-hmm. But when we got there, everybody in the unit had to be brought up to speed in their mines because they're all Yugoslavian mines. And we did them with live explosives in them, with the fuses in. That's the engineers, the cooks, the clerks, the drivers. They had to be able to recognize them and where to put a safety pin if one was available. Other than that, they wouldn't try and pull them out of the ground or anything. That was our guys' stuff, our guys and gals' stuff. And there was mine awareness. There was mine awareness given in the schools and things like that. We had an EOD team that would go around and show the kids. And they would come in and say, I found this over there. Because a lot of their minefields were not recorded. A town would be given 20,000 mines and they'd sprinkle them out around the fields. And then kids would be walking on them or cattle. But there was mine awareness given.
Okay. Just be careful not to hit the table.
Okay.
How did the Canadians compare to other national contingents in terms of training and equipment?
Well, we're superior.
Yes.
Yeah. The British, for instance, they didn't have the equipment heavy enough to lift the bridges in place. We'd send them a crane to help them do this and help do that. The African countries basically showed up with nothing. We had one corporal from Nigeria, his section came with us. They were supposed to be engineers, and they had one shovel. Who else was there? The Nigerians, the Kenyans. And these guys from Africa almost froze to death. They had first-rate British equipment, and one of them died of hypothermia in October. So you can imagine, we had to go down and teach them how to, the layer principle, and for instance, One soldier asked if his eyeballs would freeze. Another one wanted to know what the bug looked like that gives you frostbite. They were totally unprepared. And at times we would come to a roadblock where they were supposed to be manning it, and a Serb would be manning the UN roadblock. So they were totally ineffective. The Finnish soldiers were good. They normally are. I'm trying to think who else was there. We didn't see any Americans at that time. There was no Americans involved in that. British soldiers were good. They always are, but we're always in competition with them anyway. We always come up on top.
What did you think of the mandate and the rules of engagement from the UN?
Well, if you know what happened to Lewis Mackenzie, Major General Mackenzie, it was just he'd phone in New York on a Friday and there'd be nobody there. There'd be an answering machine. And our rules of engagement, every time we went out, I would go into the ops room and say, what are the rules of engagement? And they could be different from sector to sector, village to village. We always had our weapons loaded, although sometimes we weren't supposed to. But you never knew what was going to happen there because you'd go by the pubs over there and there'd be guys sitting out on the patio drinking slivel bits. And with their AKs, they're ready to go. So you never knew what was going to come in. You know, you'd stop these roadblocks and these guys would be doing it. But the mandate itself was It kept them apart, I think, until 95 when the Croats took the rest of their land, which was traditionally their land. But the Serbs said, like, 600 years ago, that was part of ours. But for us, it was, we were glad to get out of there, because Croats didn't want us there. The Serbs did, if it fitted to their thing. But personally, I don't think it was a good tour.
Yeah. Was there any ever stretching or wink-winking of the rules of engagement that you saw, other than, obviously, Lewis Mackenzie did some of that?
Oh, sure, he did.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he pretty well had to. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, no. I don't. But I'm not every place every time. And the soldiers were, they're well-trained. They're that well-trained that they looked after themselves.
Having been on other peacekeeping missions in Cyprus and the Gulf, how did Croatia compare?
In what way?
In all ways, in terms of the mandate, the rules of engagement, the preparation, the equipment.
I think we were definitely well prepared enough. There was no big secrets when we got there. Mine's a mine. We got to learn that right away. First day we were there, that's what we learned. And then we were briefed on what the situation was. The commander of the contingent was a major, I think he was a major general in the Indian Army. And he was really professional. But compared to Kuwait was like 8 days after the war. We were there. And we went into Iraq and we went into Kuwait. Kuwaitis, we didn't see any until they started coming back because they were so wealthy they all left. The Iraqis, on the other hand, were very poor. And I found them friendlier. They weren't as snobby. They didn't have anything. They're under a tyrant. Cyprus, we knew what the mandate was when we got there, and it had been going for 10 years at that time. The first Canadians went over in 64. It was the Van Duz Royal 22nd. So we'd been there for 10 years, and we were there 4 months before the Turkish army invaded. So it got pretty exciting there for a couple of weeks. They had basically two wars. And after that, it calmed down again. But it was what we practiced for. I was with the Airborne Regiment at the time. When I went to the Gulf, I was an engineer regiment, and I was an engineer regiment in Croatia. So I would say that of the three, Croatia was down on my list, was the third on my list. Because UNPROFOR did not work. And it was the hostility that was shown towards us when you're trying to do your job. Kids are kids. Kids are always good, but the adults, they were just so set in their minds. The dislike was just palpable, you know, it was just unreal. And even though we were there trying to help, they didn't want us there. So I'd say there, my top peacekeeping mission would have been Cyprus, because I've seen everything. Croatia, or Kuwait and Iraq was interesting, because I'd never been to that part of the land before, and I went to Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and all these other places. So, and Croatia, initially when I got there, I thought this is going to be great. Within a couple of days, it was, you could see it wasn't doing very good.
Okay. What did you think of the international response to the conflict, like the UN and the European community? Do you think it was enough?
I think they had enough there, but they didn't do anything. If they wanted the Canadians in Croatia, and yet the main thing was down in Sarajevo. That's why Major General Mackenzie brought the Van Duz down. He had to have something to try and protect that airport. And the response was no. The Serbs shelled Sarajevo for how many, 9 or 10 months? I mean, they ruined a beautiful city. For what? I mean, they were all living together initially. And then they get UNPROFOR started, which was supposed to keep the Serbs and the Croats apart. They did reasonably well, but in 95, the Croats had built up their army enough and went right through everything. So no, I don't think the mandate was, or the enforcement and all the rest of it was all that great. It was a typical UN snafu. It just wasn't working.
What would you have done differently if you were in charge?
Well, I would have put in a lot more forces, maybe a lot sooner. And if they got Milosevic out of there a lot sooner, they would have probably got rid of him. He was just another dictator going in. He went from a communist dictator to a communist dictator, but only without the communist.
Okay.
And I think they would have kept that country together. Because under Tito, he carried a big stick. But from World War II right through until he died, or 9 or 10 years after he died, they were a rich country, were cohesive. They had a good tourist industry. They had everything going. I spoke to the lady that ran our bar, and she said every year they drove to Germany on a trip, or a holiday trip. They had no restrictions. They had free university and free medical under Tito. So, did I get off that question? What was that again?
That was about the international response.
Yeah, I don't think it was a strong enough response. And I think they waited too long. But, I mean, that goes up to the diplomats. That goes at the high end. I mean, us sit down at the bottom of the soldiers, we're just told to go in and do a job. You know, you don't really question it. But if you read into it, like a lot of soldiers don't read into it. They just say, okay, they want me to go over there. I'm going to go over there, and I'm going to do whatever I have to do, and then I'm going to go home. But if you read into some of this stuff, you just shake your head. It's like they've never been there. They're sitting back in some office somewhere, and they say, oh, don't you think you should do this, without understanding what their complaints are about each other and all the rest of it. So my personal opinion would, no, I don't think it was enough response.
Okay, and my next question is sort of related. Did people back home understand what was going on, and on the military side as well as the civilian side?
I think so. I know my family did. I think if anybody's got somebody overseas, any family that's back in Canada got somebody overseas, they pretty well keep themselves informed of what's going on. I know my wife and kids did. Because we got leave. I got home for Christmas, which was incredible. And, you know, when I was in Cyprus, we were there for 6 months. We didn't go anywhere. Actually, I was there from April to December. And we got leave to go to Germany or wherever you wanted to go, but not all the way back to Canada. So, and then we had telephones that were just, these satellite phones was just like phoning next door neighbor. So the young guys or the soldiers would be phoning home, tell them what's going on, and you know, you don't tell them everything that's going on because something might be a little dangerous. You don't want people back home worrying. But I think they were pretty well informed. Because we used to get papers, we used to get our newspapers. It might be 4 days to a week late, but it would show what was going on over there and all the rest of it. So I think anybody reads the papers or watches television had a pretty good idea.
So did you feel like the press coverage was good?
I think so. And we had, I think there were 7 or 8 reporters come and stayed with us for a while. Went out on the various sites. There was a lady from the Vancouver Sun there, and her concern was how you're treating the girls, and it was no different from the guys. So, but I think they were pretty well covered.
And in some of my reading, it talked about how the press was used as sort of a tool against different sides that wanted you. Tell them that you'd have the press and this would be in the newspaper and it would be a deterrent?
Yeah, yeah. I think that was going on. I'm not a big fan of the media, although it's supposed to be there. It's supposed to be... It was partially responsible for the disbandment of my old regiment, the Airborne Regiment. The politicians and the media, they assassinated it. And the things that they brought up other than the black boy getting killed, the regiment was cleaned up by the time they disbanded it. And but they just kept bringing these tapes, kept appearing from before, you know, things like that. And they didn't, if it sells papers and gets you to watch television, they're going to put it on there. Did they use it for, I don't know, for making the other side think something? They could have. I know Lewis McKenzie would probably use it, you know, if he thought that I've got to do something, and the only ammunition I got is if I can use the media to help me out there. But
okay. And what about the military headquarters in Canada? Did you feel like they understood what your requirements were and what you needed from them?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought we were well supplied.
Okay. In terms of your supply, a lot of it was coming from Germany because they were disbanding.
Well, they weren't disbanding Germany yet. They didn't leave Germany until 1993.
Oh, right.
But a lot of the furniture and things like that they brought down, it was just cheaper to leave it there. Because when we left, we were replaced by the Argentinians. And we just basically left stuff there. Unofficially, we gave a lot to the civilians that were there. I gave Vinicus boy. He took my bed. I had one of these captain's bed that was made in Germany or Denmark. It was a beautiful bed. Gave that to him. We looked after that Muslim family. We gave away some deep freezes. What are we going to do with them? You know?
How did your family and friends cope with your absence?
Well, it was my fourth UN tour. I think it was hardest on my daughter. My last trip, she was 14, and she was a little concerned about it. My boys were, they'd been used to it, and they were in their late 20s, and so, well, other concern, but they said, well, he always looked after himself before, he'll be all right, and I was.
Are there any incidents that stand out for you? Were you shelled, shot at, obstructed in any way?
Just, I think it was 2 days before I got there, Sergeant Mike Ralph was killed. I had Mike in Germany when I was there from 85 to 90. He was quite a guy from Newfoundland, so was his wife. And what had happened was, he was coming back from another job and he'd seen a section engineer clearing this roadway. So he stopped with his driver and he went out to help these guys finish clearing this patch of road. So they were just about done and Mike says to his driver, he said, I'll go back and pick up the truck. And the driver said, go ahead, Sarge. As soon as he got in, and we think it was a remotely controlled IED, blew up, and the only thing that kept him together was his skin. His blood was bubbling. I was talking to the medic, and he said that the soldier still thought he was alive. It wasn't. It was just his blood bubbling. So he was killed instantly. And the day I drove into the camp, well, I was back in Canada when it happened, and my commanding officer called me in, and he just wrote it down on a piece of paper and handed me the name. He was on the phone talking to somebody in Ottawa. And I said, Mike Ralph. So then I got over there, and as I drove through the front gate, they still had his truck there. I said, why do you still have that truck here? You know, it's not a deterrent. It's just upsetting people because they see it, and they think of Mike. And also, just before I got there, there was two of the sergeant majors from the engineer regiment rode jogging, and they... There was a small bridge up ahead of them. They heard a bang, and they went up, and this young boy had been there fishing. He stepped on a mine, an anti-personnel mine, and blew his foot off. So they carried him back to the hospital. And while I was there, he'd come up to the camp to visit because he wanted to thank the Canadians for saving his life, or he would have bled to death. And while I was there, how many incidents? Just on the other side of the ceasefire line, a farmer was out there on his tractor plowing his field, and one of the Croatians, we presume, shot him and killed him, sniped at him. And there was incidents like that. A lot of alcohol involved with the Serbs and the Croats. And I remember down in Sector South in a town called Knin, it was, I hope I don't get this mixed up, it was occupied by the Croatians. Well, two Serbian soldiers had friends in Knin that were Croats. So they got a little intoxicated one night, and they wanted to go visit their two Croatian friends in the village. So they walked down the main road, and as soon as they were seen, they were shot. Hauled up to the main square and laid there. So there's their friendship. Stuff like that was just so inane, you just couldn't. It's pretty hard for us to fathom stuff like that. And you try and grasp all this stuff, and you think, you know, man, people in Canada don't appreciate what they got, you know. I think when I was in Kuwait, we were replaced by an engineer squadron from Valcarte, who were all French-Canadian. And we were out in the desert there one day, and I was showing the other sergeant majors around, and the young driver who had an English name but could barely speak English, and he said, I wouldn't know how to solve the problem in Canada. He said, we bring the French population over here for a weekend, there'd be no more complaining. So no matter where I went, when I came back to Canada, it was, even Germany, I spent three tours in Germany, 14 years, but even Germany, which is just a great place to be if you're not here. It just felt so good to come home. I very seldom travel now. I just send my wife's German, I send her back to. But I have no desire to go. Other incidents? I've sort of drawn a blank there. Maybe I don't want to remember some of the stuff, but the ethnic cleansing. Well, anywhere you drive, you see these villages that are deserted and burnt and everything else. And by the look of it, they were perfectly good housing. You know, they weren't starving there. They had good economy. They had food. Everything was going. And then they just, especially the tourist hotels, they blew them all up. I mean, shoot yourself in the foot. when they go into each other's villages, the first thing they do is blow up the church or the mosque. You know, and of course, to a Canadian going over there, look at our churches. There's 92 in Chilliwack. We don't go around burning each other's church because somebody preaches or believes in something else. And over there, it's the norm. And dealing with the Russians was another thing. We'd go to Sector East, and where do they put the Russians? Right with the Serbs. Well, they've been bedfellows for hundreds of years. So we'd try to put in a protest about what the Serbs are doing, and the Russians wouldn't hear about it. So you're sort of banging around there, and you just... what else did I see? I just can't think right now, Dana.
Well,
you know, I could always add to it if I get home. I could send you an email and just, oh yeah. Because normally when you're sitting with somebody else though, that was there with you, they'll say, oh, remember this happened, remember that happened, you know. Oh, I know when, shortly after we got there, like in the village, it was a fair-sized village, I'd say 5,000 or 6,000. The soldiers were allowed to go into town because they had pubs and, of course, they had girls. And I think we were there 3-4 weeks. My driver was run over by a drunk Croatian policeman. He was in uniform. And the policeman went up on the curb, and his leg went right over his back. And I, at 3 o'clock in the morning, the MP sergeant woke me up. She was a female MP sergeant. She said, sir, your driver is in the hospital in Virovitica, which was 50 kilometers north. It's a Croatian hospital. And I said, what happened? She said, this drunken Croatian policeman run him down. And it was a good thing there was a British major there who was medically trained. So I drove to the hospital. When I got there, most of his chin was gone or scraped down to the bone, his nose. The gravel was still embedded in his forehead. And they had drilled through his leg without any anesthetic. And this thing was about the size of my finger, my little finger. And I said, he was from Newfoundland too. He said, Arsene, he said, they won't give me anything to kill the pain. So I spoke to the doctor who had been trained in Germany, and it turned out that he did everything correct, but it was just like 30-year-old technology. So I asked him why they couldn't give him anything. He said, well, he had been drinking. I said, he had a beer. So I went and got our doctor, who happened to be Chinese-Canadian from Vancouver, Dr. Barry Fong, and he came up, and he said, I'm not supposed to get involved because of the Hippocratic Oath or the procedure. You don't deal with another doctor. And I said, you better give him something. So he did. And I also had his best friend, this other corporal, come up and stay right in the ward with him. And then when they operated on him, it was right from his hip right to his ankle. He was opened up, and there was these bars and pins and everything else. And the doctor was holding the x-ray up to the window, and I had my video camera. And I videotaped the whole thing. It just came out perfect. So he had that when he came back to Canada, when he went to Veterans Affairs. Unfortunately, he would have been a master warrant officer now, easy. But they wanted him to remuster to a clerk in the Air Force, which is just not his thing. And now he's already got his mate's papers with the tugboats. He lives about a block and a half from me. I see him all the time. He's got two great kids. And his wife just got her degree, and he's really doing well. He still plays hockey. Plays with my son with that league. Back to Derivar, we were about the same time as this happened, or maybe a week later. This guy walked by this pub, and he threw a grenade in. And what he did that is that his girlfriend was there, or ex-girlfriend with her new boyfriend. And they don't have any control on their munitions there. So he threw in a grenade, and it went off, and there were several people wounded. There was no Canadians in the bar, but there were some of my soldiers walking by, and they ran in and gave first aid to them. But the CO said, the commanding officer said, and he was a great guy, he said, I don't want to do this, but we've got to put the town out of bounds. Because if we'd lost one of our soldiers, we had no recourse. We had no, what would be our excuse, you know. So we did. And what we did on the weekend, on Saturday nights, one weekend it would be the officers, and then the next weekend it would be the senior NCOs, ward officers, sergeants, and then it would be the master corporals and corporals. We each gave them a weekend, and they had to come up with entertainment. And the locals would be invited. Now, I don't know if this makes any difference. They could bring a grenade from town into the tent or the big tent or vice versa, but it worked out good. On a personal note, we had 48 Mounties that belonged to my mess. Now, some of these guys we didn't see because they were on the other, on the SERB side of the line. But I became very good friends with two of them. And plus, every Monday night we got the hockey game. It was no commercials, no nothing. It was just a straight hockey game. So the place would be packed. Everybody would watch the hockey game. And I had to laugh. There was a knock on the door, and somebody came and got me and said, RSM, there's a Dutch soldier wants to see you at the door. And I went over, his nose was bleeding and his lip was split. I said, what happened to you? And he said, well, one of your Canadians hit me. He said, what happened? He said, well, they had the hockey game on, and I changed the channel. I said, see you around, buddy. Come to the wrong guy. And what else? I became pretty good friends with two Mounties, and what I think Jim Girdlestone, still working in Vancouver, and Bruce, the other fellow, I think it's Maidstone, Saskatchewan. Anyway, they came to me one day, and they said they'd been speaking at a school, and there's these two sisters who had lived on the Serb side at a village called Pakrak, and they wanted to go over and see what was left of their home. The Mounties were traveling, were not armed. They weren't armed unless they flew them into Sarajevo, and then they had to wear a helmet and flak jacket. And would I provide them an escort, my driver and I? So we took the two Mounties. Well, the two Mounties had their own car. They followed my Jeep or my five-quarter. And I had one of the aunts and the two sisters in the truck. And as soon as we drove in the driveway of this small home, all these people came out from all over. And they were all hugging and kissing them and everything else. You know, you okay? And this one guy had, he brought all the religious icons and all that and gave that to them. And then they said, what happened to our parents? And there was, their parents were speaking to this Serb guy. And this guy walked by and threw a bomb through the window, and he killed all three of them, including the Serb. So this guy had buried them, all three of them together, and there was a big mound of earth there. And I had this in a video camera. They use it on BCTV News, as a matter of fact. So anyway, the girl told me, the youngest one was 16, and she was bitter. She pointed down the road, and there was this guy standing there, and she said, that's the guy that threw it. These girls were jumped out their back bedroom window, which was onto an open field leading up into the woods, and they snuck all the way around into Croatia. So we did that, and it was pretty emotional, pretty heavy. You do something like that. But we did it, and I wasn't supposed to do that. You're just not supposed to do that kind of stuff, but I felt real good when we did it. And then everybody, of course, nothing sacred in the Army. As soon as we got back, everybody knew about it. And everybody was saying, hey, way to go, you know, stuff like that. Another thing we did when we were closing down the camp, they had an embargo on the Serb side, and we had some Mounties in one of the villages there. And when the regiment from Germany was there, this old Serb gentleman shows up, and he says, I think I'm allowed some Canadian medals. I was in the Canadian Army. He said, and this fella, who since died, he came to Canada in the 30s, and he worked on the railroad and the logging camps and everything like that. And when the war started in 39, he joined. And joined the Royal Canadian Engineers, and he went to England. While he was in England, they formed a Yugoslavian National Army. So he asked the Canadians if he could go with that army to free his own country. And they said, sure. So they let him go. So once the war was over, you know, the communists wouldn't let him go back to Canada. So he was still there. Sure enough, he was entitled to three medals, and we presented them to him down in the village. And another time we were having a medals parade up in our camp in Croatia. And of course, these Mounties that were down on the Serb side, they made up this old fella a UN identity card and hung it around his neck and brought him to the medal ceremony because his best friend was a lawyer and he was Croatian. And we watched these two guys, and both of them just bawled their eyes out. You know, they were just so emotional. So that was another good thing we did. So we're just about closing the camp down, and we've got all this medications left. And like I was saying, there's an embargo on the Serbs. I got ahead of myself. Also, these Mounties have brought the old Serb gentleman up. They only got electricity certain hours of the day, not very much. And they asked me, would it be possible to get a generator? So I got a big pump and generator, and we hauled it down there, so we lit up the whole place. And then, just when we were closing down, we had our medical room was full of medication. Because we'd visited wives, and widowed women with kids and all the rest of it. So we translated all the medicine into Serbo-Croatian and delivered it to them. And prior to going over, and I forgot to tell you this, I was given $2,000 by the local Kiwanis Club to distribute as I seen fit. So what I did with Vitica, who was our head bar girl, I said, I want you to find me two Serb widows and two Croatian widows. So we did. And they all got $500 each, converted into marks. And while I was visiting these places, I would see all these widowed women. All they wanted was their husband's body back, and they never got that back. But the kids, they were doing their laundry like they did before the turn of the century. They're using ashes, things like that. I mean, everything was spotless, but they're using technology that was... So anyway, we went and got all this medication, and we distributed it. We didn't give it to the authorities because it would just disappear. And we'd give it personally to the people, and the most thing they wanted was soap, shampoo, and toothpaste, just so they could keep themselves clean. You got to understand, the women had no place to get sanitary napkins, just for instance, stuff like that, nothing. So we were and I had a young translator with me. She was a university student from the university in Zagreb, and she mentioned that to me, and I said, "Well, we'll go get some." So we took boxes of that with us, things we would never think of here, you know. So that left a good taste in my mouth, like we're doing something, you know, because it's such a male society over there. These guys, or the ones that got the power, they've really got the power. I mean, these people don't even question that. So we did something, and my boss knew about it. My major knew about it. He said, "Just don't get yourself in trouble." He said, "Well, you don't even know about it, so you know." And I think that's about it. We did.
I want to go back to you talking about hockey games and morale and stuff. So
yep.
How is morale, and what did you guys do? Okay, we'll wait until that. Okay, so we were going to talk about morale.
Yeah, the morale with our guys was good. We had a rink there. We played broomball, floor hockey. The regiment before us, they had challenged the Russians that were in the next sector, and they came down, and our guys kicked their butt pretty bad, so they wouldn't come down anymore. But they had we had a gym that we used in the town. We played basketball. We had, as much as possible, we had PT every day. But a lot of the guys were staying out in these different villages. And not wise to go jogging through the woods, you know. And I'd been in places where the guys just improvised their own weights, you know, things like that. I would say that morale was great, even though they'd only been home 11 months before they got sent over there. They were told we're going to be home for 2 years, and 11 months later, sorry about that. It's not hard to build up a soldier's morale. It's real easy to destroy it, but it's not hard to. If you look after them, they'll look after you, and you wouldn't believe how they look after you. But if you're a jerk, I mean, I had the same policy I was taught when I was a 17-year-old on my junior NCO course, firm, fair, and friendly. Not too much in the friendly. And you look after them, and that's it. Canadians are amazing. They're pretty well accepted everywhere. Croatia, I think, was the only place where people were a bit cold towards the Canadians. Even the Arabs, especially in Iraq, they loved the Canadians, and we were part of the coalition, although they didn't see us. Cyprus loved the Canadians. Europe, Germans, they thought we were great. Because we don't sit in our camps. And I hate to use a comparison. Well, I will use a comparison. The Americans start their own. When they move somewhere, they'll have a little America there. Well, we don't. We go out and see what the public's doing, you know. I got there in September 1664 in Deverl, Germany. At that time, we were part of the British Army of the Rhine. And that Christmas, I was at a German family's home for Christmas. And that was not uncommon. I didn't know what I was eating. I knew it was good. And I didn't speak very much German. And then the young boy, I guess he was 6 or 7, he went and got one of his books out of his room, and he pointed, I was eating rabbit. It was great. I'd never eaten rabbit before. Of course, I never had snails until my daughter was born either. But that red flag, or that red maple leaf, means a lot. And I think it means a lot in Afghanistan, too, to the everyday person. I've talked to a lot of guys that have been there, and they're building schools, and they build a school, and they'll go back 2 months later, the Taliban's blowing it up because They don't want anybody to get their foot in the door there. So they go build it again. You know, another thing we did in Croatia, I don't know if you ever heard of the Izzy Dolls. A corporal named Isfeld got killed over there, I think in 92. And his stomach, even before he was killed, his mother made these little dolls. They came from up the valley around Comox there. They're both dead. Our mom and dad just died within the last few years. So they were called Izzy Dolls, and now they're all over the place. Like when Canadians go somewhere, they take boxes of these Izzy Balls because of the other dolls, the other mothers have started making them. He would pass these out to the kids. Something like that over there. Kids just thought it was great. Even in Croatia, you get a kid that's 8 years old, speaks English, Serbo-Croatian. If he's on the Serb side, he speaks Russian, Serbo-Croatian. But that's not uncommon anywhere in Europe, except France. In France, it's mainly, they speak French. But you go to Belgium, they'll probably Flemish, which is Dutch, French. You go to Germans, all the Germans, that's their second language at school. Except they're a little shy. But they see the Canadian flag, it was like a free pass, you know. In Holland, you go there now, the war's been over since 45. You wouldn't believe how they treat you there. And Belgium, I was telling you about Belgium in the car there. I would go to Belgium to that liberation march in the Madame de Groot, where I used to have my camper van, and I'd park right in her driveway. And inside the garage door there, she had a key there, hooked up there for me and my friend that used to do the walk all the time. So we'd get the key, we'd go in, and there would be our breakfast laid out for us, because she had her and her husband would go open their feed shop. And we'd normally we'd get these bags, these little Canadian flags, you know, you put in your lapels. Well, there's 1,000 in each bag. And the kids would just be wearing all these, and just pretty good feeling. I mean, that's the impression that put the people, Canadian soldiers did during the war. And the graves are looked after by school kids. You know, we have November 11th here. I remember when I was driving the school bus, I said to this girl, I said, this is junior high school, and I said, you know what day it is today? And she says, yeah, it's the 6th of June. And I said, what day in history does that mean to you? And she says, nothing. I says, D-Day. She says, what's D-Day? Maybe they didn't, but I remember learning that in school. You know, I'm taking a World War II vet, a D-Day veteran from the Royal Winnipeg Rifles, and we're visiting what they call chance school. It's the last chance. Once you're out of that school, so my buddy's son is now a teacher there. So he called his dad, do you know who would come out? So I'm going to go as the guy from after World War II, and he's going to come with me, the other fellow. I said, it might be a rough go. He said, no, it's rough enough in the Germans, so I think I can look after some Canadian kids, and we'll see what happens. But, yeah, Canadians are pretty well accepted. Not pretty well, very well. So.
Can you tell me what happened once your tour in Croatia is over?
Yeah, we came back to Canada in February, March, and 2 months later we were down in Wainwright practicing mine warfare with concrete mines. And the brigade commander came around and he said, how's it going, RSM? And I said, sir, how do I motivate my soldiers to play with concrete mines when they just spent 2 tours of overseas lifting up the real thing? Well, it's something we have to do. And I said, well, you tell them that. I can't. And that would be 93. And then it was just a matter of 23rd of July, I walked off the base, and then I had 14 months leave. I remember I told you I didn't get up until 94. Officially, I was on the books until 27 September 94, which gave me 34 years and 11 months or something like that. And the only reason I got out is because they were going to post me the following year to Cold Lake, Alberta. I loved it. I had the time of my life. I was in trouble when I was a young guy, and the Mounties recommended I join the Army because I was in the reserve. My dad was killed in 42, so I didn't know him. And I was basically had no discipline, and I wasn't doing all that great in school. So then my commanding officer was my math teacher, so I was called to his office one day. He's sitting there with a corporal in the RCMP, and they say, we know what you've done. We highly recommend you join the Army because you're doing well in that part of it. I said, well, I have to get a letter from my mom, and he said, we've already got it. So it's the best thing ever happened to me.
It talks about how in your bio you talk about how you refused an extension as the RSM.
Yeah, that's what I was telling you about. I asked for one more year as the regimental sergeant major, And they said, no, we have two other, the rank to get in that is chief warrant officer. And he said, we have two other chief warrant officers that have to go to a regiment. And we just can't give you the extension. No, they were good about it. So I said, at that time, they were reducing the forces drastically. It was called the Force Reduction Program, FRP. We called it the Golden Handshake. And I said, well, I'm going to put in for the FRP. I did this before I went to Yugoslavia. But it takes a year. Once you put it in, you can't pull it. You can't go in and put it in on Friday and go in Monday and say, I've changed my mind. Once you put it in, that's it. So I had a year. You still had to do a year. And I was given a great send-off. The soldiers in the regiment bought me golf clubs, golf cart, golf shoes, and golf lessons. So I walked out of there. I felt really good about everything. I took the 14 months off, and then my friend who was in the Army with me, and he used to work for me. He did 28 years and got out. He was driving school bus. He said, why don't you come down and try it? And I just thought it was so great dealing with the kids. I just love the kids. And the only reason I stopped driving is I was diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And I noticed that I was losing my concentration and a lot of anxiety. And I didn't say anything to anybody. I just said, well, I was almost 61. And I said, I'm going to retire, blah, blah, blah. And then I was in seeing my doctor. He'd been at the Battle of the Medak Pocket. I don't know if you ever heard about that. The Canadian government kept it quiet for 10 years. He was there. So he basically was one of the guys that wrote the book on PTSD, and I was in there talking to him. And he said, you've never talked about your experiences. And I said, no. He said, do you ever have any problems? I said, yeah. I said, pull this guy's leg off in Cyprus. He'd been wounded, and we thought it was just a broken leg, and we put traction on it. It came off in my hand. And I said, I was dreaming about that the other night, and I was covered in sweat. And then I started to cry. I bawled my eyes out. You know, I haven't cried since, I can't remember. He said, you got PTSD. I said, I'm not going to see no shrink. He said, you don't have to. So he tells me, what do you do when you do this? And I told him, I said, listen, doctor, I said, I had to quit driving the school bus. I was missing kids at their stop, and I was forgetting to let them off. I was thinking, my mind wasn't there. He said, do you alienate yourself? And I said, well, a lot of the civilians I work for, I've got no use for them because they don't even think we should be allowed to work there because we're getting a pension. So, you know, you go to England or America, if you're a retired veteran, wow, they put you on a pedestal. Not there. But anyway, I said, I love the kids, but I just couldn't do it. And I said, I was wondering if I'm losing my concentration, I could get in an accident with those kids in the bus. And he said, yeah, you're right. All right. So I said, I just decided to do it. Did I go off track there again?
No, that's fine.
No? So anyway, I got diagnosed with this PTSD. I could call my doctor anytime, and I'd go in right away. Like, I've got something really that's bothering me, and normally what I'll do is I'll get out and go for a walk. My wife has a hard time understanding the PTSD and that, because I think I built up this big macho thing in front of her, you know, big sergeant major and all the rest of it. Not so much her, but some of the other ones, that it's pretty hard to fess up to stuff like that, you know. And since that time, I belong to the PPCLI Association, and there's one guy there who was in World War II and Korea. He was wounded 3 times, and his buddy was sitting there. He was a Korean War vet, and I told him I was getting this PTSD, and he said, what? We never got that. We got shell shock and things like that. Well, 2 weeks later, they called me up, and they said, yeah, we've been diagnosed with it. How many other guys in the military from the war that just are probably dead now because of that? They've shot themselves or drank themselves to death, you know. Amazing. And what these young guys are seeing now? Brutal. We had occasion where we had Master Corporal Franklin come out to our Legion. Fell at lost both legs. One of the first ones he's a medic. Came out with his doctor, and we had him there for a luncheon, and we raised $10,000 during that luncheon. He quit a guy. Really quit a guy. 42 years old when he joined. I said, what was wrong with you? He said, I wanted to see what it was like. And he got up and told the whole story. He had slides there when he ran over this IED. And that's when that diplomat was killed. It was in the same vehicle. And he said one of his legs was gone. He elected to have the other one taken off after he came back from Canada because he knew what it would entail to have the surgery done. So he figured he'd be better off to have two stumps and learn how to walk, which he does. And he started a foundation because when he was in the hospital, he'd seen all these civilians that weren't getting the same treatment. And he said, why can't they get the same treatment as me? Well, it's money. But he was a serviceman, so they were given, like one of his legs cost $60,000. So he started this foundation. That's what his aim is. Not only just for the military, but to include the civilians. So things like that. It's pretty hard to assimilate back to City Street. What they have in the military is what they call a SCAN seminar. It's a Second Career Assistance Network. And you go there and you learn everything. You learn how to deal with civilians. Like they tell you, you guys have been in a cocoon, you guys and gals. You know, it's different out there. You know, they don't have the cohesiveness like they do in the military. There's always somebody there to help you. Your buddies, you know, things like that. When you get out in the real world, it's dog eat dog. But down at the school bus depot, there's 14 ex-military sitting, working there. We all clung together. And the four Mounties, retired Mounties, were with us. Because we'd all gone through something that was similar. And a lot of them respected us, but there was about five or six that we what they call us, organized welfare. Things like that. You know, when you just look at them, you just smile. Anyway. So anyway, I go, if I got a problem, I go see my doctor. I've got another good buddy that was in Cyprus with me, and a big native guy. He's now the transportation supervisor. He's the guy that got me driving the school bus. Now he runs the place. $70,000 a year, not bad. He's not bad for a Cree from Alberta. So I go, him and I go and talk quite a bit because it's bothering him too. You know, he's seen a lot of crap happening. See, in Cyprus, it was bad. Some of the things that are coming back now, you see babies that are killed. Babies. Like I see my grandkids, my little grandkids, you know, I just couldn't imagine. You see this stuff and it's just. So I could say there's some unofficial shooting going on. The Canadian side, when we see stuff like that, it's not the way to play the game. So,
yeah. This is in Cyprus?
Cyprus and Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in Yugoslavia, they'd kill the women and the old people and the kids first. When they seen real soldiers, they wouldn't stick around until we'd show up, and then they'd just scatter. But there were rules of engagement. We couldn't do this, we couldn't do that. We could have gone in and saved all kinds of people. They wouldn't let us. Mackenzie broke rules of engagement lots of times. You know. But they're so scared covering their ass all the time that, you know, the young officer's not, geez, if I do that, I'm not going to get my next promotion or something like that. It's the way the system works. They come to a regiment, they know they're only going to be there 2 years, they got to make their mark. So if they screw up, that could be the end of their career. Mackenzie didn't give a damn, he was Major General. But he was good ever since he was young officer all the way up. But that's about it.
So was there, they do a psychiatric evaluation now. They didn't do that when you came back?
Yes, they did. When we came back from Kuwait, there was a Navy commander there. And it was like a questionnaire. And of course, I put the big act on. I don't have any of that. No. Well, in fact, I did have a lot of yeses there, and I just said no. And then when I was looking for volunteers to go to Yugoslavia, because we didn't take the whole regiment, we had 300 in Kuwait, I found out the guys were going through the Padre, and a lot of them were going, when they got to the Padre, they said, I don't want to go. But I don't want to tell my buddy I don't want to go. And he told me that in comments. I never said nothing. I said, yeah, that's fine. You know, if they don't want to go, don't. We had enough volunteers. But some guys, once they got in behind the door there with the Padre, they didn't want to go. So, would you ask me again?
About if there was an evaluation when you came back.
Yes. Yeah, there was. The results of, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I know one of my soldiers from Kuwait who contracted something over there. We don't know what it was. He was the best runner in the regiment, George McDonald. He's a car salesman in Abbotsford now. They were putting him up for release, and his transfer came through to the Air Force. And he transferred to the Air Force and finished off his time. And he got out, and he went in for an evaluation. And he was bad. He was really bad. And he sort of runs like a group, I guess something like AA. They all sit there, and they talk about their experiences and that. But he's the most successful car salesman at MSA Ford in Abbotsford. I go down and see him once in a while. Well, I get my truck service there. So every day, every time I'm going to go down, I phone him and we have a coffee together. And there's lots more. There's lots of serving soldiers that are getting treated for that.
Yeah. If you could change it, would there be anything different you'd do about how they conduct the evaluations when they come back?
Well, yeah, because before we didn't know that. When we came back from Cyprus, they never even heard that term. Never heard that until the Gulf War. And I really wasn't bothered by this thing in Cyprus until, well, I guess about 10 years ago. I woke up and I was just soaked in sweat, and I was making these funny noises, and my wife grabbed me, and then a couple other times, once she woke me, I reached up to grab her. And I was dreaming about the Serb, stuff like that, you know. And then I told the doctor this. He said, yeah, that's, things like that happen. You know, he said, you're not alone. You know, good club to belong to, eh? I only sleep 3 to 4 hours a night. The doctor gives me these sleep pills. And he said, try not to take them every night. So last night at 9 o'clock, I went to bed, and I read now. That's one of the, I had to go see the sleep specialist, this doctor. Do you like to read? And I said, oh, when I was in Germany, all I read, we didn't have TV or anything like that. So I used to read all the time. I used to get back into the habit. So I'll read. Well, last night at 12:30, I'm up. Went to bed at 9, I'm up at 12:30. So I just get up and I do a little work on the computer or watch a little bit of television. You know? And I was just dozing off again when my alarm clock went off. But then he'll give me these pills, and about every 3 days I'll take one. And I'll sleep an extra 2 hours. And especially if I've gone to the pool that day, it really worked out good. And then try not to have a nap in the afternoon or anything like that. So I don't feel bad. The only thing he's worried about is my weight. He said, you got to lose weight, because you weren't like that in the Army, were you? And he's a runner, tall and slim. It just makes me sick. But he guaranteed me he's going to get me up to 75. And he said, it's the guy up top is going to keep you going. So he said, but you got to help me. So he wants me to get back to my 40 pounds. Through getting a bagel in the ferry, and everybody's getting these nice big bacon and eggs and sausages. Anyway.
So, I'm just going to go back and see what I've written down. So, you mentioned a couple times women in the military. So, they were just starting to...
No, they started to come in Germany in the late 70s. And now they're integrated. Yeah, I was down at the airborne reunion, and they were down there. They're jumping with the guys, out of planes and stuff. And there's no big deal. Yeah. They do PT tests like everybody else, and I never had a problem with it personally. And I'd been in for 30 odd years then before I had actually women working for me and with me, and I didn't find any big deal. Neither did the soldiers. You know, they're brought up, this day and age, they're brought up like that. You know, and I put certain showers on, and then one day there I see girls come out of the shower anyway. They couldn't wait. And it was nothing big. You know, I didn't go running to the commanding officer. The girls are in the shower, and at the same time, they all got their own stalls, so what's the difference? So, no big deal.
But you talked about how the press was...
Well, they were trying to make something out, and they couldn't find nothing. The girls all said, we're not having any problems, you know. So nothing ever was written about it. So.
I think that's it.
It might be good, because it's 12:16.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you, Gary. Okay.
I mean, if you want to carry on, I'll stay until 3.
Nope. I think I got everything I need.